Welcome to Resistance Roundtable, broadcast on WPKN the second Saturday of each month, where we engage in conversation about local and nationwide organizing for a more just and democratic America during this pivotal and dangerous moment in our nation's history. Hosting today's show, as usual, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, who was a longtime instructor in literature and writing at Central Connecticut State University. She's a member of the Executive Committee of the Connecticut Conference of the American Association of University Professors. Ruth also serves as a member of the Board of Directors and a theatrical director with the Westport Community Theater. And Ruth is here in the studio with us today. Hey, Ruth.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Richard Hill is our host this morning. What day is it? I'm getting very confused. It's been a crazy week. Richard Hill is host of WPKN Show's First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio and Organic Farm Stand, and a rotating host as well on Mic Check. Richard is a musician, teacher, and mentor with Youth Radio Connecticut. I'm Scott Harris, host of WPKN's weekly public affairs program Counterpoint, as well as Between the Lines radio news magazine, and both Ruth, Ann, and Richard are contributors. Right now, we're very happy to welcome our good friend John Nichols back to Resistance Roundtable. He's here to provide us some analysis, some of the major and consequential issues confronting our country and the world this week. Thank you for being here with us this morning, John.
It's always an honor to be with you.
So let me just do a quick introduction and we can get to all that's happened. John Nichols writes about politics for The Nation as the magazine's national affairs correspondent. John is also a contributing writer for the Progressive magazine In These Times and associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper of Madison, Wisconsin. John is the author of more than a dozen books. Recent titles include Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers and The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics, and Horsemen of the Trump Apocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Most recently, John teamed up with Vermont Independent Senator and two-time presidential candidate Bernie Sanders to write this really great book titled It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. John has been a longtime supporter of WPKN, as well as independent, non-commercial community radio nationwide. Welcome, John. Thank you for being here.
It's an honor to be with you.
So, lots to get to, and I think I'll start off our conversation by asking you to assess President Biden's Thursday night State of the Union speech. Trump and Republicans have, for many months, painted a picture of Biden as a human vegetable, unable to walk, think, or speak. Many observers believe that the GOP setting expectations so low backfired on them. But beyond the style or performance question for Biden, John, I wanted to ask you about the substance of his speech. And what did he say that speaks to his agenda in the next 4 years if he should win re-election? And will it make a difference to undecided voters, most of whom did not watch the State of the Union speech? I think only about 32 million people did watch. Certainly not anywhere near even half the voting age population. So I think that's the opener there for you, John.
So let's parse it a little bit and say, first off, that yes, 32 million roughly saw it. That's huge, by the way, in the overall scheme of things. There aren't many shows or performances or whatever we want to say in culture or in politics that get 32 million viewers. So it's a significant number. And, of course, we know how the State of the Union operates. It's not really the speech. It's the coverage of the speech. It's the reaction to it that matters. People pick up a little bit on their evening news or on the morning news as they're going to work or whatever. They pick up a paper if they still read a newspaper or see something online. And the overall playout of the speech was that Biden did well, that he was, in fact, energetic, on top of things, seeming to enjoy himself, sparring with the Republicans. They would yell something, he would respond. And so far from being incompetent, he seemed quite on top of things. And so that in itself, just stylistically, was beneficial. But you correctly go to the issues and say, you know, what did he say in here that was substantive? And I'm afraid that, you know, this becomes the complexity, right? We're all so focused on the stylistic side, the question of can this man who is in his 80s, you know, handle the task of delivering a State of the Union address? The answer to that question is yes. But when we focus so much on that, we miss a lot of the content. The content was consequential. Now, I'd say there's a few things that were really important in this speech. And first and foremost was the economic message. And that economic message was a pretty solid one. It was pro-labor. He even went to the point of recognizing the head of the UAW, Sean Fain, who responded very positively to that. But within it, there was a kind of tweaking out of the Biden model for how he does economics. And that model is not anti-corporate in the way that, say, a Bernie Sanders might be, or much more so, or not anti-billionaire in the way that Sanders might be, accepts the reality of corporations, but says they must be controlled, right? They must be tempered, and says that they must pay their workers well, that unions must be strong, et cetera, et cetera. And he really drove that home on a lot of levels, both, you know, thematically, but also with content, with specific proposals and ideas. Obviously talked about his infrastructure bill, which has turned out to be a pretty substantial initiative. The other area where he went, which was, I think, it saw some of the more combative and interesting moments of the speech, was towards social policy. And obviously, he was quite firm in talking about the IVF issue, which arose out of Alabama's effort to ban it, and also in general the question of reproductive freedom. It was fascinating that he literally looked at the Supreme Court justices who were sitting there, who had overturned Roe v. Wade, and delivered this very political message, which is, you know, watch the power of women and watch the power of Americans as they vote to protect their right to choose. These are obviously core messages for a campaign, but it's also thematically pretty good stuff. Where I thought he was weaker, quite frankly, was on, you know, foreign policy. Now, a lot of people, you know, obviously he started on foreign policy, had some strong statements about authoritarianism, and I think that was very appropriate and fine. But when you got into the nuance of it, he didn't really advance things very far. He didn't give us all that much clarity on you know, sort of the ongoing U.S. Engagement in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Obviously, we know where he's at. We know what he wants, more resources, et cetera. But that conflict is coming to a point where, you know, there almost certainly has to be some sort of negotiated solution, and he really didn't tweak that out particularly well. He also spoke about Gaza and about Israel-Palestine. There again, though, there was sort of a gray area. He's talking about the need for humanitarian aid and building a, you know, sort of sea bridge or, you know, a port, floating port or whatever to get humanitarian aid. But that didn't, you know, again, this is just this sort of, you know, building around the core issue rather than getting to the heart of the matter. And that is Israel continues its assault on Gaza and continues to block land delivered aid in many senses. And so he, you know, he showed an element of humanity, but he didn't show a clarity on how to get to that next point. So that, I think that's an overall taste of the speech. There's a lot more to it. But at core, I think those were sort of the core takeaways that I had. Strong on economics, pretty strong on you know, social policy, particularly right to choose, and then a little grayer on the area of foreign policy.
Thank you for that, John. Richard Hill, our co-host, has a question for you.
Hey, John. Great to have you again.
Richard.
Yeah, I wanted to drill down a little further into the things you were just saying. I mean, the way I perceived the speech and the kind of dichotomy that you suggest there between domestic and foreign policy, I saw it as a kind of a heaven-hell situation. I mean, Katrina Vandenhoevel, commenting on Soto, noted overtones of FDR, you know, and his demands to increase taxation on corporations and billionaires, support for unions. I mean, he even mentioned the PRO Act, which is the Protect the Right to Organize Act, which you know, would have passed in the initial Congress right after he was elected if it hadn't been blocked by the filibuster. His call to increase the minimum wage. I mean, he didn't mention $15, but one would hope that that, that was in his sights. On the health side, we have his unqualified support for the extreme right-wing government in Israel, you know, with no hint that he'll cut off the supply of bombs that are targeting Palestinians in Gaza. And add to that his unquestioning support for NATO expansion, actually, which is inflaming and prolonging, I believe, the war in Ukraine. Then we have his bellicose posture toward China and Iran, which I guess, you know, he feels like he needs to somehow outmaneuver Trump on those issues. Americans, I think, seem to be paying far more attention to foreign policy now than in the past. And many seem to be alarmed at the billions of dollars that are being spent on U.S. military campaigns waged all over the planet. So my question is, can Biden wage a successful reelection campaign based solely on his progressive domestic proposals? Or will voters make him pay for this new Cold War that he's waging, which includes in the main target in the sights, of course, is Russia, which is costing taxpayers billions and increasing the threat, really, of another worldwide conflict? How is that going to play out, the foreign policy versus the domestic agenda?
Well, in a sense, Richard, that depends on developments somewhat beyond Biden's control, i.e. what actually happens out there in the world, right? If there is a temporary but lingering ceasefire in Gaza, i.e. if the bloodshed stops, that will ease some of the tension, the anger with Biden for his support of Netanyahu. Now, that won't ease it with everybody. There will be plenty of folks who say, you didn't act when you should have acted, you know, months before. But if a ceasefire does come and things begin to stabilize to some extent, if humanitarian aid gets in, then I think the Gaza issue becomes less of a pressure on Biden, right? Less of a political challenge. On the other hand, if the Israeli assault continues, if, frankly, the horror of what is going on there continues, the death toll keeps rising, the destruction continues, the literal spread of starvation expands. If that is the case going forward through this political year, then I don't think there's much question that Biden will lose some support from his base. And why that is consequential is because though Biden is dramatically more popular than Trump among the overall electorate, right? That he has his popular vote win in 2020 was a 7 million vote win, which was far more than most victories in the history of the country. And so he's got enough of the electorate that he can probably prevail, but that's not how elections are decided. Elections are decided at the state level. And in a number of the states that are in play as battlegrounds, potential battlegrounds, people who are concerned about Gaza are a very significant factor. We look at Michigan, of course. It's much talked about with its large Arab American and Muslim American population, very, very passionate about ending the violence in Gaza, but also with its large student population at University of Michigan, Eastern Michigan U, you know, Michigan State, all these different campuses around who are also young people very concerned. Then in Detroit, you know, in the black community, a historic sympathy for Palestinian rights also continuing to have a factor. Now, that's one state. You go over to Minnesota, another state, which is not often understood as a battleground, but it is. Trump only lost Minnesota by about 45,000 votes back in 2016. Again, a very substantial Muslim American, in that case, Somali American population, as well as a lot of very liberal progressive voters in the Twin Cities. I think similar case you see in Wisconsin. I could go down state by state. But the bottom line is you end up in a situation where Biden could lose the presidency, not in the popular vote, but in these battleground states, and that a key factor in that would be his failure to stand up to Netanyahu in the way that he should. So there's a political, you know, there's a political component to this. We should never lose sight, Richard, and I know you don't, of the moral component, right? There is a moral component that says you should do the right thing, end the killing. But there is also a political component, and that often influences those who are in positions of power. And that political component, it's quite obvious, is a factor here. And so I guess that's a lengthy answer to a core question, and that is, will Biden's foreign policy positions, which are unpopular, at least particularly, I think, as regards Gaza, will that become such a weight on him that he cannot be reelected? The answer is, you know, what will the situation in Gaza be in October and November? And if it is stabilized, at least to some extent, then I think it is less of a challenge. If it is not stabilized, I think it could very well prove to be a burden that might be very difficult for Biden to overcome. As regards Ukraine, I think that's much less of a factor. I don't think that people are particularly focused on Ukraine at this point. I think certainly there's a lot of people who, overall, I think the American people tend to be sympathetic with Ukraine. But as you suggest, I don't think people want to have a war with China or Russia or anyplace else. I also don't think that they think that's actually likely. And so I think the Gaza thing becomes the more profound political issue. Ukraine a little bit less so. And beyond that, there's a lot of other foreign policy that's consequential. But we come back to the core reality, which is that our presidential races in the United States do tend to be decided based on economics. And so if you've got a little bit of stabilization as regards foreign policy, then people do redound back to those economic issues. Can Biden win on the economic issues if that's the core focus of the campaign? The answer pretty obviously is yes.
So I'm concerned. I mean, I understand that the situation can change. It's very fluid. And there could be a diminution of the slaughter that's going on in Gaza right now based on, you know, political things that happen. But it seems to me that Biden's base, you know, the young people, the African-Americans, the Arab-Americans, people around the country that are really concerned about this, will not be happy if it's just sort of a slow slide into a reduction of the slaughter, and that without a definitive stance by Biden against the very right-wing government that is perpetrating the slaughter right now, a demand that there be a ceasefire from Biden and the State Department, and a threat to cut off military aid to Israel, without that, I fear that his base, his activated student, African-American, Somali-American, as you pointed out, Muslims around the different states, that they will not be inspired to change their track right now.
Well, I understand what you're saying. And I think that's exactly the point I was making, is, you know, we'll see what the situation is as you get toward October and November. Again, what you're talking about, Richard, is a much bigger development, i.e. that the U.S. might actually change policy as regards Israel. I don't anticipate that happening. I think it would be appropriate. I think that there is a need to attach restrictions to aid to Israel. I think there is, obviously, there's a need for the ceasefire, and it needs to be not only immediate but permanent. But I think that the long history of U.S.-Israel relations is such that while people know what they want, i.e., while voters say these are our goals, if there is a relative level of stability in the region, I think that probably still gives Biden, you know, much more space in which to communicate to his base about domestic issues, about economic issues. On the other hand, if it is an immediate and ongoing crisis, if there is still a rising death toll, if there's still increasing destruction, if there's still mass starvation, if you've got that going on, then I think it becomes a much bigger problem for him. Of course, there will be people, voters, who will not forgive Biden for failing to act, right?
Yeah.
But I think think at the end of the day, I'm not sure that that will be a sufficient grouping to prevent him from being reelected. And remember, one final thing here, and this is the biggest thing of all, and that is that ultimately elections become a choice between, you know, usually two candidates. In this case, Biden the Democrat, Trump the Republican. Many of the negatives on Trump begin to mitigate against some of the anger at Biden. Now, with all of that said, the margins are so close in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, a number of others, that I believe that, again, both for the moral and the political reason, Biden should do exactly what you're talking about, Richard. I think it is the more appropriate move morally and politically. It is the wiser move morally and politically. And because I'm not sure he will do that, because I, in fact, have real doubts that he will do that, I think that means that we're going to look at a very tense and uncertain electoral process going forward through 2024.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
John Ruth Ann Baumgartner, our co-host, also has something to ask you.
Well, actually, John, to confess, I'm ripping up paper over here because they took mine.
Of course. That's the nature. We have our set of issues, don't we?
We do. We do.
All of us.
But I did want to acclaim the fact that your written columns are such wonderful focal points for the larger issues that we begin to encounter when we read every newspaper in the world and when we watch a lot of television and listen to a lot of different radio and et cetera stations. And I had a particular thrill this past week. I subscribed, by the way, to the print version of The Nation. And your column, How Biden Can Win, with its focus on Michigan, was particularly interesting to me because my sister and her husband recently moved to Michigan because they had two motives. One was they wanted to be closer to their daughter's family, and the other was that they wanted to help increase the Democratic vote. This is true. increase the Democratic vote in Michigan. So I read your column very closely because I thought, well, this will give me an idea of what their chances are. And I found that when I listened to the State of the Union address, I wasn't listening with my usual ears, which are, what is he going to say about higher education and what is he going to say about the extremist of the liberal positions, et cetera. But this time I was listening with the ears of Michigan, or at least the ears of my sister. And it was a very interesting experience for me. I kind of want to ask you to comment on the difference between these interviews you give to the lucky and also to writing a column and condensing everything that you want to say on a particular angle or a particular subject into just one printed page, at least in
that's a very good question. Yeah, look, you know, one of the challenges of writing for a magazine that now comes out monthly, right? Much bigger magazine, but coming on a monthly basis, is that you sort of have to write ahead of the curve, right? You have to write on bigger, broader topics and hope to say something of consequence therein. Obviously, in radio interviews and TV interviews, I was doing MSNBC yesterday, you get a chance to speak in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. And that gives you more nuance, more perspective, I think. And also, like in a show like this where we're talking for a half hour or some portion thereof, we can go a lot deeper. One of the interesting things about print, and you know this, Ruthann, if you do a long interview with someone, for instance, and then you transcribe it. If it's a half-hour interview with somebody who speaks, you know, pretty quickly and coherently, you're going to have piles of pages. Right? Mm. You're gonna have, you know, a half-hour interview can you know could fill the better part of a magazine, right?
Right.
And so you obviously cut things down to try and get to core points in print, and even online, because you don't want to write so much that the people give up on reading you. On the other hand, in a broadcast setting, and that's why these different platforms are so useful, in a broadcast setting, you can go deeper And also you have that dialectic that we have here. You know, Richard and I were just talking a moment ago about Gaza as it affects the politics of it. Richard bringing up very good points, and you know that for me at least helps me to get even more focused and more clear on some of the arguments we make. So I think that in a sense as a journalist, I am lucky because I have had an opportunity to operate on multiple platforms, print, digital, broadcast, both radio and TV, and also even in person to go give speeches and talks. And I think all of those platforms allow us to communicate different parts of the same core message. And I guess if we come back to that core message, you know, when we're talking in 2024, it is that Joe Biden is running for re-election on an awfully lot of levels. He's a preferable candidate to Donald Trump. But there are things he has done and is doing, particularly on foreign policy, that make him vulnerable. And I guess it gets to a core question. Joe Biden says this is the most important election maybe of our American journey. This is the election that decides the health and safety of our democracy. And yet, to my view, he still seems a little casual about taking stands, taking steps that would strengthen his ability to run for re-election. And that's, to some extent, what I was talking about in that nation piece, the how Biden can win arguments. You know, he needs to be pressured by progressives to take better and stronger stance as regards foreign and domestic policy that will help him to win. He ought to listen to his base. That's one of the reasons why you mentioned Michigan. The campaigners for a ceasefire in Gaza named their campaign Listen to Michigan. Mm. And interestingly enough, the campaigns that have picked up on it now in states like Georgia and Wisconsin and other places, arguing additionally for more uncommitted votes, are calling themselves Listen to Georgia, Listen to Wisconsin. Hmm. So there's something of a movement here, which is along the same lines as the column that I wrote, saying that Biden does need to listen more to his base, because his base actually is telling him what they need.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, what happened in Michigan and Minnesota and may happen in other states, as you said, John, is really a very powerful example of organizing, not to undermine Joe Biden, but potentially to strengthen him if he listens, yeah. You know, as the name implies.
Well, and I think that's an interesting thing, you know, because he has listened to some extent, Scott. You know, it's interesting. Michigan voted on February 27th. Like February 28th, 29th, here you see Biden saying, oh, we got to do a lot more humanitarian aid, right? We're going to drop aid in, and now he's got this, you know, sea-based aid mission, and even ramping up talk about a ceasefire. That's not satisfactory. No. That's not enough, in my view, but it's clear that he heard something, and it's sort of an encouragement to the activists across the country to make some more noise, right? To do more campaigning at the state level, because my sense is that there's evidence that Biden might listen. Right. And one final thing I'd say on that, Scott, is that if you distinguish that between Trump and Biden, that may be the biggest distinction. Biden, with his imperfections, does appear to listen. Trump, I cannot imagine that he would listen.
Right. Well, I had a further question on the Supreme Court. As most of our listeners are aware, the Supreme Court decided to hear arguments on Donald Trump's insane total immunity claim. And they're not going to hear that case until April 25th. They may not hand down a decision on it till June, which has effectively delayed the trial start date on the charges brought by Special Counsel Jack Smith against Trump for his role in the January 6th insurrection and attempted coup. If, as expected, that trial won't begin or conclude before the November election, the right-wing majority in the Supreme Court are depriving voters of a clear verdict on one critical measure of Trump's fitness for office, and that's his treason, again, in my view. It also seems to me that Attorney General Merrick Garland is responsible for the situation as he waited 2.5 years to charge Trump with crimes that he committed in plain sight of millions of Americans on live television. It seems to me, and maybe many of you listening, that our justice system is broken. What do you think, Jim?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's broken. You know, I have an inclination to say beyond repair, but obviously we have to repair it. So, you know, I guess I won't go that far. But at this point, it seems to be in complete crisis and chaos, right? I mean, it is a chaotic, messy situation where it's barely hard to keep track of not just the charges against Trump, 91 indictments on a variety of criminal charges, but also the litigation as regards how and where and when he will be prosecuted. I dare say that the average American, you know, long ago threw their arms up and said, you know, I can't keep track of all this. Right. You've got to be a, you know, kind of a political or legal geek to be on it, you know, on top of every aspect of it. And even then, I think it's a struggle. So there's a mess. And let's parse a little bit here and say, first and foremost, Merrick Garland failed. He's been a lousy attorney general. He is too cautious. And you know, Barack Obama wanted to appoint him to the Supreme Court. In many sense, he does have a judicial style, right? Mm. You want a judge to be, you know, thoughtful, somewhat cautious, responsible. I think that, that Garland fits that model. A prosecutor or a law enforcement officer, and that's what an attorney general is, you want that person to be aggressive, to be focused, to be, you know, trying to get things done in a, again, responsible way, but with, you know, some sort of sense of urgency. Garland has lacked that. He is guilty of malpractice as an attorney general, and it is writ large across the delays in efforts to hold Trump to account. Remember, Mitch McConnell said back in 2021 when he blocked conviction for impeachment that this would be sorted out in the courts. Well, it hasn't been, and the delays are justice delayed. Remember, when we talk about justice delayed, that's not just for a defendant. That is also for society. Right. And what the Supreme Court is doing now is delaying justice. It is also once again, and I emphasize that once again, intervening in the electoral process to put the thumb of the court's majority on the scale. And that's what they're doing here. They're delaying a legitimate prosecution of Donald Trump for seeking to overturn the results of an election, a host of other actions, which ought to be litigated, which are legitimate to litigate, and they're delaying it to a point where, while that litigation may occur, it might not be completed until after an election, thus leaving the American people without the information they need to cast a fully informed vote. So it's an awful thing that the court is doing. It's an incredibly irresponsible act, and one that, you know, again, argues for court reform, including the expansion of the court to put new, to put more and better justices on the bench. And I would close off just saying, you know, for those who are very angry about this, you should recognize this is not a new development. This is a pattern with the court. They just in recent days refused to enforce the 14th Amendment to the Constitution with a convoluted argument that goes against, you know, election law and election practice for centuries, that the states don't have the ability to decide on the qualifications of candidates. And somehow this becomes a federal and congressional activity. That's just, it is clearly making a poorly thought choice and a damaging choice. But the bigger reality of the court putting its thumb on the scale goes back to 2000, and we should remember that in the context of the 2024 election. In 2000, in Bush v. Gore, the court intervened and shut down a recount in Florida that had every potential to review or to reveal that Al Gore had been chosen by at least plurality of the voters in Florida, thus giving him Florida's electoral votes and the presidency.
Right.
The court came in and stopped that count. And in so doing, they effectively decided the presidency of the United States. A handful of justices, you know, elite justices sitting in Washington on the bench. The reason we should think about that in the context of 2024 is it is not beyond possibility. In fact, it's just what we've been talking about as regards to Michigan and other states, that you could have a result in 2024 that has very narrow wins, real conflict as regards electoral votes, and potentially issues that go to the Supreme Court. And what we're getting is an indication that this Supreme Court cannot be trusted to enforce the law and to seek results that reflect the will of the people rather than the will of the justices on the court. So we are in a very problematic situation with our judiciary. And that won't become an issue if, for instance, Joe Biden wins by a landslide, right? But on the very real prospect that it isn't a landslide, we again have to be concerned about the court meddling and intervening in places where it frankly shouldn't be.
And we have to get rid of the undemocratic Electoral College national popular
Absolutely.
Vote. Another topic.
Start there.
But, John, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
A couple more, sure.
Okay. I think Richard, we'll get back to Richard here for another question.
Thank you. Yeah, John, I don't know if you've heard this. I just heard some whispers of this, that Biden's handlers are proposing that Biden will go for Trump's jugular, poking him every day with insults and jibes that are designed to drive Trump into a hysterical frenzy and reveal him as the colic baby that we already know he is. I wonder what you think of that strategy. And without also including substantial proposals, progressive policy proposals, to give fodder to his agenda and to try to reach that part of his base that I don't think was particularly impressed with the State of the Union address, because I think they probably looked at it and said, what the hell is he yelling about? I can barely understand what he's saying and that kind of thing. You know, people sitting in bars, let's say in Ohio, drinking a beer and they're looking at the screen. First of all, I want to know what you think of that strategy of poking Trump, showing Biden to be like on the offensive, being the aggressor here. And then without including also new progressive policy proposals, what does that mean?
First and foremost, let me suggest to you that there probably weren't that many people sitting in bars in Ohio drinking beers and watching the State of the Union. they were undoubtedly watching a game or talking to each other. That's one of the challenges with the State of the Union. Scott pointed out earlier, you know, you had 32 million people watching it, but that was only about, you know, under a third of the people that vote for president in a regular November election. So I think that the core question you ask is a good one, though, an important one. And that is that Biden says he's going to go on the offensive. That's a good idea. You know, I mean, politics is a fight between two candidates, right? One of the big battles of each candidate is to define the other one. And we know what, you know, Trump will say about Biden, and that is that Biden's incompetent and that he's ruined everything. It is valid for Biden to come back at Trump and to come back aggressively. And there's plenty to work with. I mean, Trump is literally saying that he would be a dictator, at least for a day and potentially day one. And as we well know from history, if you're a dictator on day one, the rest of it is settled, right? That's the end of it. And so to talk about that, to talk aggressively about that, I think is important. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. By the same token, the point that you're getting to, Richard, which is vital, is that that won't be enough for some substantial portion of voters. There has to be a kind of a two-step here. First step, yes, define your opponent, you know, clarify that you are different from your opponent and that you disagree with your opponent and that, frankly, in this case, your opponent's election would be very, very damaging to the country. But then secondly, you have to give people something to, you know, sink their teeth into, to look forward to believe in. Politics, for all of its negativity, for all of its cruelty, is ultimately about at least a measure of optimism. You vote for someone because you believe, ideally, that they will be better, right? That they will do more, that their election will have some sort of positive impact on the country. And Biden needs to talk a lot more about that. Again, Ruth Ann was mentioning this column I wrote in the print issue of The Nation recently. That's at the heart of it. Biden does need to clarify that Trump's a bad player, but Biden also needs to have a clearly defined progressive agenda. And his message can be, it doesn't have to be that complex, but it's a core one. If Biden wants to win, what he has to say is, look, reelect me, give me a Democratic Congress. We won't stumble in the way that we did in the first term. We won't let the filibuster block us. We will get rid of the filibuster, and we will start to govern in great big ways, and that is passing the PRO Act so that unions can get stronger, passing all sorts of reforms as regards, you know, elections and policing and all sorts of other issues that people really care about and that have been on the agenda that got passed by the House but didn't get passed by the Senate. What he has to say is, you know, look, give me the power. We will start to pass all sorts of things that really matter. We'll make unions stronger. We'll get health care to more people. We will get education to more people. We will protect Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security in fundamental ways, and not just protect them, but expand them. And we'll do all these things, right? So it's like people can say, look, wow, you know, I think voting for this candidate will actually give me a better life. And that's what Bernie Sanders has always said. That's what progressives have always said is, you know, look, run on an agenda that makes it clear your election matters. And I do fear that Biden may not do enough of that. And that's for him, that's a dangerous game, because simply clarifying that you're better than Trump will get you a long way in America at this point. But as we know, in this bitterly contested, narrowly divided country, it may not get you far enough, because Hillary Clinton ran against Trump, you know, quite clearly, you know, even at one point calling his supporters deplorables, or some portion of his supporters deplorables. And she was very aggressive, right? But that didn't get her across the line. Biden in 2020, when he beat Trump, he got across the line. How did he get across the line? Frankly, he put together those unity commissions right after the primaries, worked very, very closely with Bernie Sanders, frankly, developed an agenda, a program that was actually quite progressive. And that, I think, had a big impact on mobilizing young voters, especially, but also others.
Wow. Well said, John.
It's a great way to conclude this conversation. John, thanks for your common sense analysis on the constant chaos we're confronted with. Appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
It's a great honor to be with you. And your questions are always so provocative and smart that it's hard to break away from you.
Okay, we're all blushing here. All right, thank you. Thank you, John.
Take care. Be strong.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's John Nichols, The Nation Magazine's national affairs correspondent. And this is Resistance Roundtable. You're Scott Harris with Ruth Ann Baumgartner and Richard Hill. And we're here the second Saturday of each month on listener-sponsored WPKN. I know, Ruth Ann, you had a lot to say that you didn't get to say when John had to fly. But,
well, most of what I had to say launched from that column, and he did take it, so that was good. That was good.
I think the last question you asked, Richard, is right on the money, you know, that it has to be a duality in terms of the approach. If we're going to defeat Trump and the threat to democracy, John answered, I think, correctly, that it's got to be, yeah, attack the guy who's attacking democracy, but have something better to offer.
You know, I was kind of disturbed to hear, you know, John pointed out that the media amplification and characterization of the State of the Union address is probably more important than the address itself.
Right.
So I tuned in right after the address to MSNBC, and I switched back and forth between that and CNN. And I was kind of disturbed to hear MSNBC, which has basically become sort of the Democratic cheerleading channel at this point. The commentators were positively cavilling over Biden's So Too speech. They made it sound like William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech or Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream game changer, you know. So I wonder if you folks worry that these Democratic cheerleaders are whistling past the graveyard and that the DNC will now rest on those laurels and not consider adding more progressive fodder to Biden's domestic agenda, and also consider radically changing course vis-a-vis Israel and Gaza.
I'm just curious, because I didn't tune into CNN or to see what the various kind of analysis of the speech was, but what was CNN saying?
Well, they had a more diverse panel, quote unquote, you can call, between Democrats and Republicans, if you can call that diversity. But they had a couple of Republicans, were you watching CNN, Ruthann?
No, I don't watch that.
Yeah, so they had, I think a fairly right-wing guy, I can't remember who it was, really, just condemning Biden every step of the way. And then they had one more sort of moderate Republican who I think she declared that she will not vote for Trump again. Hmm. But they were a bit more nuanced, in terms of their characterization of the speech. MSNBC, on the other hand, was like this, my God, this was soaring rhetoric and elegiac. Lawrence O'Donnell said that he had done more improvising in his speech. He broke away from his script more times than any president in the history of the State of the Union addresses. I mean, that was the kind of stuff they were saying.
They were gushing.
Oh, there you go. Gushing indeed.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, I guess, you could pick your sources of information to watch.
It worries me that people are they're going to go, oh, well, he did it. He succeeded. Now we can just kind of coast.
Yeah. Well, I don't think
that's
true.
What bothers me is that actually when you think about words, general words don't communicate. You have to, in order to make them mean anything, you have to goose them with emotion, usually. But if you speak always in generalizations, you're not saying anything. Mm-hmm. And if you put any of the political speeches we've heard in the last 10 years up against, and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream was not a political speech per se, but his speech was full of things you could see in your mind's eye. Mm-hmm. Details, pictures, not just general terminology. And you give people pictures of being able to imagine themselves in a particular life or doing particular things. And I think it's much more motivating because it has something to do with you. Mm-hmm. And more, even, I mean, Biden brought in a lot of details and stuff, but they didn't really communicate any picture of life to me. And I think that a lot of voters, maybe including me, cast their votes on the basis of the life they can see on the other side of the ballot box if this candidate wins. Well, and so if we get mostly words that name emotions rather than words that give you a picture of a particular aspect of your life, I think those are more susceptible to propagandistic use than a good, frank set of facts. Just as when Biden showed up on the picket line this year, that was a whole lot more than saying, I support the unions.
Well, you're right. I mean, poking people's emotional buttons is what Trump is all about. It's about
Absolutely.
Hate. It's about fear. It's about white supremacy and not very much camouflaged.
Right.
It's frightening to see how people, react to that.
Mm-hmm. Even when he uses a word he just made up, they cheer for that.
As we said, yeah.
Following up on what you're saying, Scott, is, Trump is an entertainer and his base is addicted to him through his previous career on television, but also they're addicted to entertainment. And, when Biden talks, people tend to sort of nod out a bit. When Trump talks, even though he's talking gibberish and inspiring really dark emotions in people, it's like a jolt to the system that they are addicted to. They're addicted to that kind of provocation. And so I think that's how he keeps his audience going. He does have the power to be a very frightening fascist figurehead because of that.
One thing that I'm concerned about, as I know we all are, and that is how the corporate media covers the election, mm-hmm. horse race, the false equivalents, Hillary's emails are as bad as Trump's, fascism or whatever right. nonsense they're going to pour out there to protect themselves from being labeled the liberal media. We're going to see that, unfortunately, play out. We've seen it. Maybe to a lesser extent than we've seen in the past, but I hope it gets better and not worse. Well, we're almost out of time here, and just to remind you, you've been listening to Resistance Roundtable here with Richard Hill and Ruthann Baumgartner, myself, Scott Harris, and we're going to be back Saturday, April 13th, for our next show. right here on listener-sponsored WPKN in Bridgeport. Stay tuned.